What's good, everybody? Welcome to Origin Story, the podcast that interviews creators about where they came from to understand how they got here. My name is Philip Russell, and I am with my co-host,
Ben Thorpe.
And Ben, today we have a special episode, I think, for you and I specifically. Who did we get to talk to this week?
We got to talk to Natalie Watson, someone that I think like hits right in the middle of all of our interests. She is someone who has been a games journalist working at Waypoint and then transitioned into game development, something that tracks pretty quickly with one-to-one with your trajectory. And I think also I made her talk. I kind of took us to a dark place and was like, let's talk about the games journalism industry, because that's something that is very near and dear to my heart, which is like, let's talk about the sustainability of like games journalism. So it was a good conversation that I think gets to the heart of a lot of the things that you and I care very deeply about.
Yeah, you know, we talk about Immortality, which is obviously the game that we talked to Sam Barlow about sometime last year, which is like this interactive movie archival game and the same kind of ilk as his other two games, Her Story and Telling Lies. So that was really interesting to hear Natalie's perspective, especially because that's her first foray into game development. So we get into all that. We really kind of dive deep into kind of the state of games journalism today, why places like Waypoint are kind of outliers in the space. And it was just a really fun conversation. So how about we save our full discourse for after the episode, and let's just jump right in there.
Whoop, whoop.
Natalie Watson is a producer at Half Mermaid Productions, where she worked on Immortality, and previously she was a games critic for Vice Games outlet Waypoint. She also co-owns the successful Star Wars podcast, A More Civilized Age, alongside former editor-in-chief of Waypoint Austin Walker, Rob Zachney, and Ali Akampura. Natalie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
Yeah, how you doing? You know, obviously we talked to Sam earlier, or I guess last year now, about Immortality, and you know, since then the game's kind of had so much praise, and you know, I know this was your first kind of foray into games development side of things. So just like, how you doing? How's life?
Things are good. Yeah, it's been a wild ride. The tail end of Immortality is tailing. We're starting to see, set it off onto its own journey, its own path. But for now, still a lot to do. Award season really drags like everything out. Like I was like, oh, I'll be able to, you know, take a step away and you know, I don't know, take some time off or something. But those awards shows, they just... it's a lot to do. Got a lot to prepare for all of them. They don't tell you that before you apply to all of them, but there's a lot to do. So, but I'm great. I'm like, I could not be happier with how everything turned out. I mean, this has been like the most surreal experience ever, going through spending 3 years making a thing that you very much cannot talk about and very much cannot show anyone and very much cannot spoil for anyone. It was like one of the hardest things ever, just like loving what I was doing every day and not getting to share it with anyone other than my coworkers, who are amazing. And then not knowing what people were going to think of it. You know, we're making this like super weird niche arty thing, and inside of already a very niche space that is the video games industry. I guess it's not really that niche. I always describe it that way, but it's not. It's a main thing. It's a mainstream thing. Games are mainstream. But I guess it depends who you ask. But yeah, I just had no idea what people would think of it. And then it ended up being that people really liked it, which is absolutely just bonkers to me. I can't not believe that people, I mean, I really like it too, but I didn't know that other people were also going to really like it. And then for, yeah, that to go beyond to, you know, being at, you know, in awards shows with like some of the biggest games, biggest budgets, biggest maps, you know, in the industry is just like totally, totally wild. It's been nuts. So, but I'm good. How are you guys?
Good. We're doing good. I kind of wanted to get you to talk about like what your work on immortality was. I mean, I think just to explain to people, it feels like that is a game that is in some ways like a lot of a movie. Like it is a movie. And so I'm wondering if working on that felt more like working on a movie set than working on a game. And like just talk to me about like what was your role in that project?
Yeah, I think it's a totally valid question because I think even within the games industry, producers there are so many different kinds of producers out there, which is something that I've come to learn over the past, you know, almost three and a half years that I've been on the game dev side of things. And then, yeah, to do this kind of weird hybrid thing was even more, you know, unique in terms of what my work entailed. So it was kind of split down the middle. I mean, the first year I started as the associate producer and my time was very much dedicated to doing a ton of research and narrative development with Sam while we were working on the scripts, working on, you know, the story and then going into thinking about like costumes and looks and hair and makeup and casting and all those kinds of things. So I got to have a really close collaboration with Sam on all the different aspects of the narrative process for the first year or so. And then, you know, it's funny because I started at Half Mermaid a month before the pandemic started. So I got like 2 or 3 weeks in office before like New York shut down. I was still living in New York at the time and New York shut down. And then, so basically Immortality has been like a completely remote project. But I ended up coming back to Los Angeles, and we ended up deciding to do the film shoot here. So I got to, I did a couple different things on the film shoot. My main role was, you know, supporting Sam and making sure that if, you know, as the director writer, there's a lot of questions being asked of him at any given time. So I was kind of like a second Sam's brain on set and able to keep track of where in the story we were and be able to answer people's questions like, wait, what layer of what reality are we in right now? So that was one part of things. And then I also was the script supervisor on set, which kind of goes hand in hand with that as well in terms of making sure continuity is being followed, making sure that like actors are like getting their lines right, or if they need help, I like will run in the middle of a, you know, after a take and kind of like run some lines with them, or making sure that like prop consistency, like nothing's been moved or touched or anything like that. That was a lot of fun. It's very stressful because we shot 3 movies and it was a lot of stuff to keep track of. But yeah, that film portion was very much run like a traditional film set. Like we had a full-fledged crew who all came from film and TV who were absolutely amazing. And we just basically shot 3 back-to-back indie movies over the course of the summer 2021. And then we went into post-production and throughout midway through the film shoot, I became the producer at Half Mermaid. So then it was like jumping into the game dev side of things and being able to like figure out our platform plans and figure out like what studios we were going to collaborate with to make that happen, and doing kind of more traditional game dev producing work alongside like ramping up our PR and marketing and making sure that we had, you know, yeah, just that Immortality was getting its sort of name out there, which we were super lucky to be asked to be a part of a couple different like games directs. I think like the Future Game Show, and there was like a PC gamer show that we got to do. So a lot of different stuff. I mean, it's kind of hard to describe what I did concisely, because I think being an indie team and then being you know, the solo producer on a project, it was kind of just like a little bit of everything and sometimes a lot of bit of everything. But it ended up being very fulfilling for me. Like, I found my I think like my work ethic and like the way that I approach things lends itself to having a lot of different hats on and getting to have a hand in a lot of different things. So as much as there was to do, it felt like every single day I was learning something new, which is like the coolest thing to get in a job, I think, is just to get to learn something every single day. So that's kind of like the overall. I hope that was useful.
Yeah, continuity alone, I feel like I would just be in a panic every day, especially with that project, because it's like, I feel like in a normal movie, when things are in the wrong place, a couple people will notice. But with a game like this, yeah, where people are poring over clips, I have to imagine that you have to be like, no, like it has to be in the right spot.
Yeah, that was definitely something that, you know, there were a lot of ways in which this was super different from a traditional film set, in the sense, and exactly what you're talking about is like, we couldn't afford to cut around things. Everything was one shot. It was, you know, essentially one take that we were using and then putting into the game. There was no editing. There was no cutting. Like, it was one thing. So it had to be perfect every time. Although if something went like a little wrong, we could be like, oh, it's the making of the movie. You know, things
movie
go
magic.
a little wrong. The boom comes down into shot. Yeah, it's movie magic. So that was, you know, that was something that we had to kind of help the film crew wrap their heads around, in terms of everything you see here will be seen. And also, this isn't going to be watched in a movie theater where it just, you know, a little error might just like graze, like, you know, you glance by, it's gone. People are going to be pausing and rewinding and pausing and going frame by frame and analyzing. And that's what we want to encourage them to do. So there can't be like, we're also not only doing that, we're also doing three period movies. So we can't, you know, we have to make sure there's no laptops on, you know, whatever, just anything that would break that type of immersion, make sure that that's nowhere to be found, which I think we had some close calls, I will say. But I think there's not a Starbucks cup in sight anywhere in our project. So I'm proud of that.
You know, like with Half Mermaid and, you know, and Sam Barlow, were you like a fan of like her story and Telling Lies before? Like, how did you kind of, I'm sure we'll get further into this, but like, how did you transition from working at Waypoint to then going to working with Sam?
Yeah, it was kind of a funny story. I mean, the first time I played one of Sam's games was for a narrative design class in college. I played her story. So that was like my first experience with his games, and I loved her story. I thought it was fantastic, and just I had never encountered anything like it. And then while I was at Waypoint, Telling Lies came out, and I think Patrick covered Telling Lies, and I remember we were both at E3 together, and we both went to like the Annapurna booth, and I was checking out Watame, and he was checking out Telling Lies, and I was like, that looks cool. And then it came out and I played it, and it was like super fucking cool, but like not enough people were talking about it. And then I ended up leaving Waypoint to pursue, there's like this like what did Natalie do for 7 months part of my career, where I took like a brief sort of detour into the esports space, and I was working on like a new gaming venture for a startup that didn't end up panning out. But I still think it was a really great idea, and maybe one day I'll get to talk about it more openly. And then that kind of started to, you know, sunset, and I was just like, hey, I'm looking for my next thing. I sort of tweeted it out, and then either Sam saw it or someone sent it to Sam, and he happened to be hiring right at, like, Sam worked on Telling, before we were Half Mermaid, it was, the studio was called Drowning Mermaid, and Sam was the sole employee of Drowning a Mermaid while he made Telling Lies. And so he was like, I want to build out a studio for this next thing I'm going to work on. I'm looking for, you know, a couple producers, and then bring on some like programming talent. So he reached out to me, and we got lunch in Brooklyn at a really yummy Italian restaurant, and we just chatted for like 3 hours about movies and games, and I think he had been familiar with some of my work at Waypoint, so he had like some sense of, you know, how what I thought about things, but we just got along really well, I think, creatively, and he offered me a job, and I was like, yeah, let's do it. I didn't expect to like make the everyone talks about the sort of transition that one may make from games journalism to game dev or the other way around. It's like always hanging in the background of those two you know, sides of the industry. I just didn't expect mine to come so soon. I always thought that I'd stay in journalism for a really long time and then one day, you know, maybe end up on the other side of things. But then it just kind of happened, and here I am.
I'm so glad you teed that up, because we have like 8 questions on this specifically, which is, what was different for you, or maybe what changed for you when you made that transition, and did it kind of shape the way that you thought about the industry, or change some of the ways that you were thinking about, yeah, the world of games?
Totally. I mean, it changed like everything. It kind of shocked me how much it changed how I thought about the industry and how I thought about players and how I thought about like what it means to make a game. It challenged all of my preconceptions of that. I mean, I think I think we have like a problem in this industry. I mean, there's lots of problems, but I think there's an issue with how obscure and like just how obscured the game development process is. I think what Tim Schafer just did with the Psychonauts 2 documentary is like incredibly beneficial to just games, the games industry at large. I hope that players watch it. I think a lot of critics are watching it or have watched it already by now. I think that like making games is so hard. It is like a miracle that games get made at all. And I can see, you know, it made me like deeply reconsider a lot of those like, it was just whatever. It wasn't for me. I was like, wow, like people poured their heart and souls into this thing. And like, it sucks that there is like this numerical grading system that this industry is obsessed with. on both sides. I think there are a lot of critics who are rightfully so moving away from it. But at the same time, on the other side of things, it's like when you see your Metacritic score going down, 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 it sucks. It hurts your feelings. It's hard not to take things personally. So that was like a big thing I realized, was just like, wow, it is really, really hard to make video games. And I wish more people understood that. I'll pause for a second.
Yeah, no, Phil and I talk about this all the time, where it's like we'll play a game before we go into an interview with a dev, mm-hmm. and we'll be like, you know, mechanics aren't really there, story's kind of interesting, okay. And then it's like we'll have the conversation and immediately after be like, oh, like that was pretty cool and they put a lot of work into that. And I think like just having access to that shapes mm-hmm. a lot of the way that you're like, oh no, like a lot went into this.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to forget that when you're just like, you know, playing through
totally.
It.
Totally. I mean, it like makes me, and it's less like, I think for the most part, there's not, it's less like criticism that I've found myself struggling with, because I think Immortality is not a game for everyone. I knew that from the get-go. And, you know, I was very much anticipating, like, I was hoping for an 8. Like, I was like, I hope we get out of, like, I hope we send this thing out there and, you know, like, it resonates with some people to the point that, like, you know, we get some, like, strong 8s out there. That's what I was, like, aspiring to. And then for the very first, because of how Edge print works, like, they, you know, it came out 2 weeks before the rest of the embargoes were lifted, and we got like this, you know, history making 10 that it totally threw me off. And I was like, oh my god, maybe this is like, maybe people are going to resonate this with this, and maybe people are going to see it for the amount of work that we put into it, because holy shit, did we like put our like heart and souls into making Immortality. It was like, just trying to make movies in general during COVID was hard. And then we made 3 of them like super efficiently. And our lead actor, Manon Gage, who's a dear friend of mine now, like this was her first role out of Juilliard, and she's playing like 14 billion different people, you know, like it's just like, it was just, We were so, so, so ambitious with what we were doing. So the fact that it was starting to resonate with people was like just the most incredible surprise that we could have gotten. But yeah, I would say that like that's one aspect of things that really changed when I landed on the other side, which is like thinking back to the way I used to so casually talk about games and not just consider what it takes to put these things out there and make them happen. And then I think like it's the harder part is like the average gamer, I think, because that's like more dismissive. It's hard to like get the sleep Twitch emote whenever your game's trailer comes up in the award show, you know, like it kind of sucks. Or, you know, just people being like, this isn't a game, this isn't, you know, this is a movie, why is it being considered for best game or whatever? It just feels like, you know, we're trying, give it a try. If you give it a try and hate it, then I can't, you know, that's totally fine with me. At least you gave it a try. But don't knock it till you try it, I think. That's a little harder. There's just no level to reason with on that front. It's like, it's not going to be for everyone, but like, don't like down it just because it's not for you when you've never really given it a try. It's just like, why put the unnecessary negativity out there? You know, I don't know.
I was just gonna say, it's heartening to hear your kind of journey of like meeting Sam and then kind of having this kind of unconventional, like you tweeted out, like, I'm looking for work, ended up meeting with Sam and it kind of all worked out. 'Cause like that basically just happened to me like 2 months ago.
That's amazing.
Where I was working in like a tech startup for the last 2 years and doing like origin story with Ben for like since 2021 and doing freelance games criticism for fun, really. And we had interviewed Chandana Ekanayake, who's the founder at Outer Loop. And when I got laid off in December, and I like tweeted out like, hey, I'm looking for like work on, I want to do something more creative, because I've been, my background is in creative writing, but I was working in marketing. And he like just responded to a tweet and was like, hey, you should That's come work amazing. Here and like similar
so
kind
you're
of
at
trajectory
Outer Loop now?
Yeah, I started in like January.
That's amazing. Oh,
yeah,
that's so sick.
So I mean, I think everything you're saying right now, I can feel that change happening in me too, just like seeing how games are made and seeing how difficult everything is to make. It definitely has changed kind of, or maybe softened some of like the maybe hardness that I had when I was more on like the criticism side of things. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not to say that I don't appreciate criticism, because there were definitely some people that came out and wrote really good or really well thought out reviews of Immortality where there were things that they didn't, you know, didn't vibe with, or just had like, I think, valid critique against the game. But like the thing for me was that it was the thing that made the difference is if I felt like it was actually like, how do I describe this? It was actually contending with the game itself in a deep way, instead of kind of writing it off. If like there were certain criticisms that I read that I could tell were like really engaged with the source, with the material itself, really engaged with you know, what we were trying to do, and like maybe talking about where they felt we missed the mark or whatever. But that I appreciate, and I think there's something to learn from, and it's valuable as a creator to like get that type of feedback. But to see the feedback like, wow, these performances suck, I'm like, no, they don't. Like, I just like fundamentally disagree with you. Or, you know, so just like making a, you know, assumption about something about the production that is just like completely off base or wrong. It's just like, okay, then I can't really, we're not on this meeting in the same sort of playing field here, where I feel like we're just on the same plane of understanding about this game. Like, I'm happy to, you know, to get feedback, but I just want it to be engaged with like what we're trying to do. Which is hard. I think as a creative, that's all you can ask for, really, is that people are going to like engage with the, you know, integrity of your game and see it for, you know, as a piece of art, as something creative that we're trying to put out there to hopefully, you know, communicate something about the way that we feel about the world, or tell a story that we think is important or something like that. That's all I think any artist or creative can really ask for, no matter where you come from in the development process or wherever. And I think the same goes with like as a critic. Like when I was a critic, it was so stressful putting out an article or a podcast or any, like it was hard. And but like you kind of become a little bit more desensitized to it because of the frequency of putting things out there. And like I can't linger on the blog post that I made about like the, you know, random itch game that I played that like didn't get any clicks. Like I can't let that, you know, prevent me from doing my work today. Like it's a new day, you have to keep going. Whereas when you work on games for years, or I think even like longer form stories that like on the critic side of things, when you're working on things for months or long periods of time, it's harder to let go of some of that, you know, negative feedback. Or
The other thing that I kind of want to just get you to talk about briefly is the state of games criticism, and you know, you're talking about everybody making this leap when they can, and I, you know, I'm in public radio, but I think that lingers in the background too, where it's like, hey, this job's probably not going to be here in a couple of years, mm-hmm. and everybody at a certain, you know, and you know, you start hitting like mid 30s or 40s, and people go to other jobs so that they can make more money. And, you know, obviously we're at this moment where Launcher saw all these cuts, GameSpot is seeing all these cuts, IGN, yeah. Fanbyte. One of the things we're thinking about is like sustainability and like what to you needs to happen in the industry to make it more sustainable. Not to ask you to solve games journalism, but please, please solve games journalism.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, it is like the most tragic thing to be like watching happen to our industry right now. It is, it's hard not to feel completely powerless to, you know, giant billionaire investors who decide they want to run a media company and then decide that, you know, that, I mean, when I worked at Vice, I saw three mass layoffs. I was almost one of them. And like Austin went to bat for me in a way that saved my job. And I was never a full-time, I don't think I was a full-time employee until like my last few months at Vice. I was always a permalancer because of just media being shitty. They like, that was the sort of, that was the run there. Like you had to be a permalancer for several years until you basically got another offer to leave. And then they would be like, okay, we'll offer, make you a job offer so that you stay, which is pretty much what happened to me, but I ended up leaving anyway. But it is, I like sat next to like this award-winning journalist for Motherboard, and she was like my idol. I was like, if I could write half as good as you, I could like die happy. I just was such an admirer of her work. And I remember one of the days of the layoffs, she got laid off, and I was like, nothing makes sense. Like nothing makes sense. If like I'm watching some of the greatest talent of this industry and, you know, other, you know, verticals at Vice and be let go for virtually no reason. So it's a difficult, terrible thing. I mean, I think a lot of people's solutions are, you know, try to get DTC, like go direct to consumer, try and, you know, work off subscribers and, you know, develop a more direct, loyal audience that will pay to keep the lights on, essentially. And I think some places are finding success with that. I don't think everyone can. Like, I don't think you can do, I'm forgetting the name of the like other subscription that came out of, was it GMG? Whatever. I'm it's escaping me right now, but, you know, I think there's definitely like that's a really attractive idea that like you'll just get paid directly by your audience for what you like want to make and they'll stand by you because they like your voice. I mean, that's the type of consumer I was in general. And I think there's, you know, some part of the games journalism audience that is that type of consumer that follows specific voices or you know, follows people's specific works because they're a fan of the way that they specifically think about things. But that's also not what the larger, you know, game news general audience is doing. Like they are just looking at whatever headline is like popping into their Twitter feed or whatever feed. So it's hard to say. I mean, it's immensely depressing, and I am like I'm at a loss for trying to understand how I don't know how I mean how we keep games criticism afloat, because so many incredible critics have now left the space to make the jump to something more stable. And with, like, understandably, because, like, the media industry is either, if they're not kicking you out, like, then you're, you know, finding your own way. So it's really tough. I mean, I feel for anyone out there who's trying to make a start in this space and, or, you know, still fighting the good fight. It's immensely valuable work. I mean, what's the point of making games if nobody's going to write about them and think about them? That's why I got into this in the first place, is I just wanted to think about and write about games for a living. That's all I really wanted to do. And then I, you know, ended up where I'm at now. But, like, it's tough. I don't know. I'm sorry I couldn't solve it.
No, you're good.
I mean, I have this question in my head where I'm like, I feel like I am like part of the audience that I'm about to ask you about. But, like, I remember, you know, when I was in undergrad back in, like, the early 2010s, you know, I used to just be like those, one of those headline clickers, like go to the IGN, go to Kotaku, go to Polygon, wherever. And then I just have like this distinct memory of like finding Waypoint. And then basically I just went to Waypoint for everything. And then, you know, through Twitter, maybe I saw other, other like sites. And, you know, obviously I can't speak to like the financial success of Waypoint, but it seems like Waypoint's doing well compared to a lot of other outlets. And I'm curious, like, you know, why do you think maybe Waypoint is Waypoint just like a unicorn in that scenario? Or,
I mean, it's funny that you describe that sort of path of finding other stuff, because I had the exact same path. Like, when I was told, like, go follow these vertical, like, you know, these verticals, the IGN, Polygon, Kotaku, everyone. And one of them was Motherboard, actually. And then Motherboard, like, through Motherboard, I found Waypoint. And it totally changed the way that I consumed games journalism and games media, because I was like, whoa, people are talking about games in a way that, like, is like what I'm trying to write at school, or like is like what I'm trying to forge, like, this, like, game studies path for myself. Like, there are people doing that out there in the world that aren't just academics. That's amazing. And then, I had a similar thing of just seeing, you know, who they engaged with and who they respected. And then that opened up my world to being able to discover new people, new voices. You know, I think Waypoint has the luck of being given the ability to do what they want to do right now in a space that, like, that's not being offered. I think that, you know, I can't really speak to specifics, but I think that they're able to be proof that you can run an outlet like this and be supported by your audience, and your audience will show up for you and will just, they're proof of concept, essentially, that, like, DTC can work. And they're being given the ability to, like, continue doing their thing, continue making their thing. And that's like, it's kind of as simple as that, just that they're being given the opportunity to, like, to do this thing. And Patrick, Rob, Kato, Ren are, you know, powerhouses. They're, like, some of the best critics in the space. And as long as they can keep, you know, my hope for them is that they can, you know, be able to foster more voices, more new talent. You know, Ren is a relatively new talent in the industry. I mean, she's come up in, like, the past 3 or so years, I think. And she's, like, one of the sharpest critics out there. It's like, that's an amazing, like, that's all I could hope for from any outlet out there, is that not only are we keeping the lights on, but that new talent is being able to be fostered and grown and, like, you know, spotlighted. Because I think that's, you know, the freelancer space is really tough out there too. Like, it's hard for freelance critics to get spots writing places because there's, like, a not a lot of places have the ability to you know, commission articles and stuff right now. So it's just, it's a really tenuous time. And I very much respect and admire the EICs out there still, and journalists, you know, everywhere, that are still doing this thing, still fighting this good fight, because without them, we would just have chat GPI articles about video games, whatever, which, like, places are already doing. They're already, like, using that shit to fucking write news blogs. It's like, what the hell is wrong with your tech brains that, like, you think this is a good idea? This is a terrible idea. Stop replacing human people's work with, like, just bad robots. It's not good. It's not good work. It doesn't make sense half the time. But anyway, that's my anti-ChatGPT spiel. But
extremely here for it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough. It's hard to keep games criticism afloat in a media industry that is just so ridiculously profit driven in just, like, obscene ways that, you know, I don't know. It's not sustainable. We're watching the collapse happen, as in the past year, of so many different outlets shuttering or so many massive layoffs. It feels like every couple months, like, half my timeline is, you know, either boosting someone or looking for work themselves, because it's just, like, it's dire straits out there. So
yeah, and it feels like it's cycles. We go through these mm-hmm. cycles of just, like, everybody gets laid off. You know, the other question, and you know, again, I'm sorry, I'm asking you these, like, very kind of, like, solve this problem questions, but
well, that's my job as a producer. It's basically to just solve problems. So I'll do my best.
Is, like, how some of that, you know, whether it's, like, building an audience that wants that level of engagement mm-hmm. and thinking about, you know, games deeply, and trying to engage with, you know, the stuff that you're talking about, where you're like, oh, this review of Immortality is good, even if it's, like, it's not 100% pro mm-hmm. because it takes it on its own terms. Mm-hmm. Because I also feel like I see so much kind of antagonism towards, you know, critique, especially among gamers. And I'm wondering, like, what it takes to foster more of that. Like, I'm genuinely interested to read this thing that I don't necessarily agree with.
Yeah, that's a tough one, because I think it's, like, a product of how terrible Twitter is for discourse, because, like, you can't like a thing or not like a thing and say that out loud without people jumping down your throat either way. And even if you say, I mean, coming from as a person who does a Star Wars podcast where mostly we complain about Star Wars, like, there's a lot of people out there who would be like, why do you hate Star Wars? And I'm like, no, I love Star Wars. I love Star Wars so much that all, like, I've spent 2 years complaining about it because I think it could be so good and I want it to be better. I mean, that's the fundamental misunderstanding, is that some people think that you have to dislike a thing to have problems with it, whereas you can absolutely like a thing and have, you know, thoughts and feelings and tensions. Like, that's what makes it good. That's what makes it satisfying. That's what makes it fulfilling. It's not just, you know, yummy, delicious, easy to eat cake. I don't know. Yeah. Exactly. It's not interesting. That's not, like, why we get into the business, I think. It's just not why any critic wants to write about video games, is just to like talk about how fun jumping is or how good the guns feel or whatever. Like, that stuff is cool too, and it's like, it's awesome when you find that. It's awesome when a mechanic like really blossoms for you in some, you know, specific way or whatever. But that's not the end all be all. Is it fun? It's not the end all be all. And like, I don't know. There are a lot of movies out there that I think are incredible films that I did not enjoy watching. Like The Irishman was like, I genuinely like that film. It was not an enjoyable watch, but I like think it did a lot of really interesting, weird things. And like, I'm glad that Martin Scorsese got to make like a 3-hour movie. Like, go good for you, I guess. Like, shout outs to Marty. Like, I mean, live your life, live your truth. So yeah, it's tough because I think people want to be, and I understand this impulse, people want to be champions of the things that they like, and they feel like they have to defend it, because also in an industry that's like tenuous and volatile, and like studios are getting shuttered, people are getting, you know, whole QA teams are getting laid off. I think people are also protective because they are afraid of this thing, somebody noticing that it's like not that good, and then like that thing disappearing from the world or not getting another chance. Like, that's the hardest thing, is like, often I play a game and I'm like, oh, I can't wait for the next one, because I think there are so many interesting ideas here. And like, I think the next one is really going to be where they get to like learn those lessons and capitalize on that. And that's like, that's the scary thing, is like, can a game do well enough and be interesting enough to land the next thing so that you get to keep making games? And like, I understand the impulse to be protective, but I don't know. Plenty of gamers are antagonistic against the games that they play every single day. Like, the amount of times Apex players are complaining about, you know, just saying Respawn or lazy devs, I'm like, come on. Like, this game is so hard to make. Like, this game is so hard to run. It's nuts. But, you know, it goes to show how much of a disconnect there really is between some of the, you know, people who have thousands and thousands of hours in a particular game and don't understand what it takes to make that happen, to like facilitate that experience. It's like, it's disheartening. But I think there are people who are doing good work, like the NoClip team, like, you know, some of these studios releasing, you know, their own proper documentaries. But it's like, it's hard to keep that type of documentation. From our perspective, just even, you know, we've been approached to do some like making ofs, and there's been, we did like an Edge piece in the most recent Edge article of like a deep dive on the making of Immortality and stuff. And like, it's a whole job just to like document everything and like archive it all and like make sure that you have something to show when people are like, hey, do you have any BTS stuff to like share with us? It's like, I have some like set photos I took like of like props and shit to make sure that like we weren't, you know, it's like, it's, everything takes so much work. It's like really astounding what the Double Fine crew were able to do with their video series. I just don't even know how. Like, it's so cool. I hope that I could have like a quarter of that type of production value into some like BTS stuff for a game I work on one day. But it's wild. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, because it's kind of ironic to say this, or like funny to say, but I'm like 20 episodes into that Double Fine mm-hmm. documentary series. Amazing, like you're saying. And you know, I'm sure they get into it, but I'm curious for you, since Immortality, you know, wrapped up recently, something that isn't talked a lot about is just like, after the game's out, like, what's life like now?
Like
what's the kind of, is it like a come down, or like, how are you I guess, how do you navigate that?
There's a hard come down. There's a hard come down. I mean, I was warned about this after the film shoot by all the film people. I like ended up becoming close with a lot of people from the film crew just because we're all here in LA, and it just, we're able to stay friends and stay in touch. And like everyone warned me, they were like, because I had like the sort of rose colored glasses on. I was like, this is amazing. We're making magic every day. This is like the greatest thing on the planet. This is like movie magic. Hell yeah. Let's get it. And you know, a lot of these people, this was like, you know, another job, or like, you know, they're coming from having just done 3 weeks on another shoot or another set, like it's, and they're lining up their next thing. And they were just like, just wait until it's over. You're going to feel super sad. You're going to be super depressed. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to be like so busy with everything else that it'll be okay. And for like the most part, that was true. I think there was this big come down because you're just, you're, your whole lifestyle changes like in a day. And like for 2.5 months, we were on set every day, like solving problems, putting out fires, like up against the clock, trying to make something good, trying to make magic happen. And like, you're just totally in it. And there was a, like, there was probably like the month after that, I was way more down, but I had enough to distract myself with post-production, getting into, you know, integrating all the footage into the, like, there's so much to do that I was able to kind of like move through that and still have a lot on my plate to move on with. But after that, after Immortality came out, it was, it was really tough, because there's nothing to like tinker with anymore. There's nothing to like obsess over. There's nothing to fill your time with. It's out there and people are playing it, and you have, there's like, it's like, and there's like this absence of control that comes out of nowhere, out of all of a sudden. And it's such a disorienting feeling. I think now that I've experienced it, it'll be hopefully less jarring the next time it happens. You know, the next time we ship a game or end of a project or something. But it's hard because there's such a high. It's such an emotional high when you release the thing. It's like you're, you know, looking at all the articles coming in, you're like reading what everyone has to say, and then like slowly like the chatter starts to slow down, and slowly, you know, there's not much to do anymore. And that's a really tough thing to grapple with. And it like, it's hard because it can often line up with like a type of burnout where like, you know, you just went however many years, however many months hard on a project, and like now you're like coping with that amount of work and that amount of energy, and you're trying to recuperate and also, you know, emotionally recuperate from putting out a thing. It's a tough thing that I think not enough people talk about at the end of a project, because you know, I think for live service games, there's like, there is no end. Like you like ship like a big milestone or whatever, and you might get like a couple weeks off, and then you're like on to the next thing. At least that's my understanding. I haven't worked on live service games, so I wouldn't know. But like, that's my sort of understanding of how that might be. But for like, especially us, we like, you know, we're lucky enough to be thinking about the next thing, and but we're not in any sort of rush. So yeah, it's like my days are weirdly freer, but I'm also weirdly, it's way harder to send even just one email, where I was like sending, you know, up to like 100 emails a day leading up to launch, trying to get all the press keys, you know, sorted, trying to get everyone, everyone's emails answered and all that kind of stuff. It like, just the shift in pace so drastically is like, it's a really disorienting experience to go through. And I feel like now I'm, it's hard because then like with each, I mean, we're lucky enough to be going through the sort of award ceremony, award show circuit, but with each thing, it's like all of this emotion, like prep, getting all the materials ready, getting everything sorted, like, you know, getting travel or figured out, whatever it might be. And then to have like this big high again of like, oh, will it happen? Will it not? And then it's like a lull until like the next thing that like, you know, it's definitely a roller coaster of emotion. And I think now that we're sort of, you know, on the tail, you know, at the end of Immortality's like post-release thing, it's odd. It's really, it's also hard to say goodbye to it. It's hard to like, I'm obsessed with this thing. I've been obsessed with Immortality for like almost 3.5 years. Like, it's hard to imagine it not being a part of my life every single day. It's the weirdest thing to think about that, like, I will, you know, one day not be talking about or thinking about Immortality. Like, that's just like an unfathomable thing to me because it's been my whole life for like almost 3.5 years. So that's also a super odd thing.
Have you started to like have conversations about what the next thing is? Does that happen somewhere in this process?
Yeah. I mean, Sam is always thinking about, like, Sam has like a bajillion ideas for games. Like, he is a fountain of creativity. And so even while, you know, we're working on Immortality, we always would like kick around like, this would be really cool if we got to do it in like another thing, or like this, we had like, sometimes we'd have an idea for something. It's like, oh, it doesn't really fit here for Immortality, but like maybe like the next game or like the next thing. So yeah, I think like we're starting to do my favorite part, which is like starting to do research. Sam, like the first week I started, maybe not the first week, but within the first like month or so I started, he started compiling this like research list, reference list for all these movies and books and music and all these kinds of things for Immortality. And that was like one of the best things we got to do, is just like go read a bunch of stuff, go listen, go watch, go play a bunch of different games. Like, just, it's as a creative, it's really hard to do that type of work. Personally, I think I haven't played many video games in the past 3.5 years. Like, I'm still at Godric in Elden Ring. Like, I'm so far behind. Like, I have so much catching up to do. It's sad. It makes me sad because I used to play so many video games for work, and now it's like so hard just to do one. It's the best thing to have like an excuse and a motivation to like just go play a bunch of stuff, go watch a bunch of stuff. So we're kind of just now getting started into that process, which is really exciting. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, because you were talking about, you know, behind the scenes stuff, mm-hmm. and I was noodling through some of the blogs. And, like, yeah. One of my favorite things was when you would have conversations about, oh, hey, here's this piece of art. Here's how I'm thinking about how we can apply it to the stuff that we're working on, which is just like, I don't know how rare or how normal that is, but it was a very cool approach.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm glad that like you read those, because those are really, that was a fun thing we got to do in the beginning of Immortality. And my co-producer Jeff and I were doing like these audio blogs at one point where we're like just chatting about production and what we're playing and stuff. And that was all, it's just hard to maintain, honestly. It's hard to like find the time of day when it's just me, Sam, and Connor on the team, and like you want to be able to keep making that kind of stuff and keep people interested, get people's wish list Immortality, get people to sign up for the newsletter, you know, anything like that. But Immortality was especially difficult in that sense because we so could not talk about anything. We so could not share like a single thing about that game because it would spoil everything. Like, because of how many layers of mystery we wanted to operate behind, we couldn't share set photos. You know, we were operating in this like urban myth of it all that like we have this treasure trove of lost footage, and like, so we can't exactly post much ahead of that, as long as we want to keep that illusion, and not to mention like some of the, you know, deeper spoilers. Like, it was so hard not to be able to like share in progress photos, or like other studios get to share like character art, or like, you know, different, like there's like a plethora of material that you can use to keep people interested, keep people engaged. And we just like did not have that opportunity. And that was really difficult because it was difficult to gauge like if people were like still thinking about this and still anticipating it and still excited for Immortality, because our only opportunity to kind of gauge that was when we would have these, you know, these appearances at some of the different Games Direct shows throughout like E3 and prior to that. And then like, yeah, the odd, you know, random interview or around Tribeca, we got to, you know, gauge a little bit of how people were thinking about it. So that was a tough thing as well, is just not being able to share anything. And but still telling people like wish list, like please, like I promise you it'll be worth it.
It rules. Yeah, it's good.
It's really good.
Can't tell anything about
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. Y'all were really, really secretive. Now that I'm kind of reflecting on it, so that is pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was wild, and it was something we went back and forth on a lot. In just like thinking about our trailers and thinking about, you know, even our tweets and stuff like that. It was really, and that's why I think we leaned on sharing so much like reference material in the beginning and like talking about art and talking about the movies we were watching and making that like letterboxed account of like all the Immortality references and stuff, because that was like something we could share and could talk towards, whereas everything else we really couldn't say anything about on our own will, like because we did not want, like, you know, we didn't want to. We wanted to keep everything a surprise, which I think ended up being worth it. Ended up working out, but it was terrifying to do. Like it was a big bet that I think really paid off for us.
I think we're winding down here. Is there anything we haven't asked you that you're like, hey, I really want to mention XYZ, either about Immortality or just kind of about you and your trajectory?
I don't know. I mean, I appreciate like the interest. I think that's really cool that it's a perspective that, you know, people want to hear about. I think you haven't played Immortality yet, I would really appreciate it if you gave it a try. I think it's a cool video game. I think it's something to share with someone. Like, I think it's an experience that is bettered by getting to talk about it with someone. Is like the mystery really starts to unravel when you get to compare notes with someone about about what you're watching and what you're experiencing. So if you haven't played it already, or if you have already played it, play it with someone new, or introduce it to someone, and just be nice to all the game devs in your life. I don't know. We're trying our best.
Thank you so much for taking the time and coming on and talking to us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I could sit here all day and chat into a microphone. So thank you for the invitation. It's been such a blast to get to talk to y'all.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that was our conversation with Natalie Watson of Half Mermaid Productions. This is where we talked all about immortality, the game journalist to game development industrial pipeline, as some people joke about, and how we are in a dumpster fire that is the games journalism industry today. Ben, what were some things that, you know, you're kind of thinking about at the tail end of this episode?
Yeah, I feel like I gently need to apologize, because I was like, let's just focus on the depths of the darkness of the world of, you know, games journalism. There's been a lot of recent articles that I think have put me in this headspace. Neiman Lab had an article like right before we talked to Natalie Watson about like, is there a future for games journalism? I think this is something that's on a lot of people's minds when you look around and you see all these layoffs at, you know, GameSpot, IGN, you know, name the company, basically.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, well, what is the future here? And I think it's obviously, Phil, something that's like near and dear to my heart, because even though I'm in journalism and it's marginally safer, marginally more stable than games journalism, it's not much. We're talking about like, you know, degrees here. And so I'm always thinking about like, what is the future, and like, what does it mean that so many people come in, I think especially as a young person, come in, write a bunch of great stuff, you know, are in the process of building their career, and then are like either fired or have to take, you know, something else to get a life that's like more stable or like pays better. And like, what does that mean for this state of like, whether it's criticism, games journalism, or just like regular old, you know, journalism and reporting, because I think both industries look very similar.
Yeah, you know, something that I'm thinking about just as you're talking about those things, and we didn't get to talk about it with Natalie specifically, but I just recently saw the Twitter handle's escaping me, but it's basically this Twitter that posts new jobs in the games industry, and they just put out this report that was essentially talking about how like 80% of the jobs that they posted in 2022 were requiring like 3+ years of experience, and how basically we're in this moment and on the game development side of things where basically there's way too many senior roles and not enough junior roles. And it's interesting analoging that next to games journalism, or, you know, journalism in general, where it seems as if there's a lot more of these entry-level jobs where people are kind of being underpaid, asked to do a lot of work, and then, you know, they're kind of burnt out and left to have to go somewhere else in order to have a semblance of a real kind of living after all these years and all this work that they've put in. I don't have like a answer or really like a major revelation in there, but I'm just thinking about that as you're kind of unpacking for us some of these ideas around like what's happening in you know, the journalism space. And you know, off air we were just talking about how NPR, for instance, really kind of bet a bit on podcasting, and now we're seeing maybe some of that bet it's not panning out, right? So we're kind of seeing like a kind of reckoning happening across the industry.
Right. Yeah. So I forget if it was at the beginning of March or it was a couple of weeks ago. Either way, NPR announced that they were going to have 10% layoffs, and they had kind of been behind. I mean, CNN and like Vox and all these other places had announced, Washington Post had announced layoffs sooner. And then it was like, is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And then NPR put out this thing a couple of weeks back that was like, yep, there's 10% layoffs coming down. And they kind of pointed at podcasts and said like, oh yeah, you know, podcast funding, ad funding here is just like not where it needs to be. And so, you know, like, we're not going to be able to keep a lot of these positions. And so, you know, a lot of people are going to lose their job. And the scary thing that happens, at least, you know, for me being at a smaller station, is that, like, you think about, like, when you apply to your next job, you're now competing, you know, for, like, even at a smaller station, you're now competing with people, a pool of people who have, like, X number of years with national public radio, like, with the big head NPR station. And so, like, it just... as the pool is shrinking, it's this musical chairs game, I think, where it's like you realize like you're in a room with people who have like much more experience, and like at the end of the day, like they're probably going to be able to hold on to one of those chairs a little bit longer than you. And so it's just like always kind of being in a place where you're like, how much longer can I do this? How much longer am I going to stick around? And you know, one of the things that I think about a lot, because I've been seeing, you know, a lot of games journalists as they lose their jobs, like tweet it out. And I was actually just kind of tweeting back and forth with Linda Holmes today. And she said something similar, which is like, I'm just happy to be here. Hope I get a little bit longer. Right. Where it's like that attitude of like, it's nice to be here, but like, you know, my time's coming eventually. Like it's like it's almost like it's a competition with the clock where it's like, you know, you don't really, like, nobody really expects to make it all the way to retirement. It's almost like they're, you know, we're all just playing this game of, like, we're here as long as we last. And then, you know, like, I hope it was a good time, basically. Which is just, like, I mean, I guess a good attitude to have, but also feels crazy to me that it's like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I mean, it's so outrageous, I think, in relation, like with Linda Holmes specifically, because it's just like, you know, she's like the face of pop culture happy hour, and which I think is, for a lot of people, when they think about NPR, whether it's like you're in the car driving somewhere or you just listen to the podcast, like that's one of the pillars of the station. And, you know, I think all this is so wrapped up too in like where criticism is in the games industry and abroad, and like, is there going to be a life for it going forward? You know, like I think even in the games industry specifically and the game journalism side, the same thing is happening, right? Where you have, like you said at the top of the show, IGN, Fanbyte, GameSpot, Polygon, where, you know, all these publications kind of axing their employees that have years and years of experience, which then just makes it that whenever there is a new job for a games journalist at any of these publications, it's like, why would anybody who's not at the caliber of, you know, ex editor at Fanbyte or wherever else, why would they even apply to those jobs? There's basically no chance that they'd get it over somebody with so many years of experience, which then I think is bleeding into what we're seeing, like what I just joked about, of like the journalist to game development industrial pipeline. I've been seeing so many replies to the, you know, different journalists who post about their layoffs. I've been seeing so many replies from people in PR, in community management, marketing, saying like, hey, you know, if there isn't any jobs for y'all on the criticism journalism side of things, like, come work on the PR marketing side of things, which is always going to be this kind of tightrope act, I think, specifically in the games industry, where there's always this conversation of like, what does criticism serve? What do reviews do? Are they like marketing? Is it supposed to be holding these games accountable? And, you know, there's obviously so much kind of vitriol whenever a negative review comes out from different fan bases of like, oh, you know, you're being paid to, you know, give it a bad or good review or whatever. You know, there's just so much kind of wrapped up, I think, in games criticism specifically, that I think Natalie is a really interesting person to talk to you about it, because in a lot of senses, she worked at one of the unicorns of the industry, which is Waypoint, which can thrive basically exclusively on podcasting and streaming, and then obviously the great reporting that they're doing. But yeah, I don't know. It just, not to say that this conversation left me like not hopeful or whatever, but it definitely just bolsters some of the questions that I already have of like, where's the future going to be for all my journalist friends out there, especially in the games industry, which seems a little bit more volatile than some of the other verticals.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is she kind of talked about like the ideal review, and like even being like, I'm not opposed to a negative review as long as it engaged with the game on its terms, like really like took the time to kind of sift through the game and what the game's doing. then I'm like still on board. And like how rare that sort of thing can be, right? And like that sort of thing takes like time and effort and work, and you know, if that's not valued, then like, yeah, it does just go away. And sometimes I'm like, you know, is this just that we're English pilled? It's like we both have, you know, masters in English, and so of course this is like what we seek out. You know, sometimes my brain worms are so bad that it's like sometimes I'm more excited to read criticism about a thing than I am to like engage with like the movie or the book or the video game itself, right? Because I'm just like, let's unpack like what this thing is and what it does. And maybe it is that like that there's not a space for that, or there's not an interest in that. But I hope that's not true. Like, I hope that's not the case, because that's the stuff that it's just like I can't get enough of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anything, what I'm kind of left thinking about, I think especially, I forget what it, maybe it was Hogwarts Legacy recently, like all the discourse around that, and like, should you review the game or should you not review the game and everything. And I think that was like a really good moment of where I initially fell on it was like, oh, I don't want to engage with it at all. Or like, I wouldn't want that. I think I tweeted like, I wouldn't want that in my portfolio or something like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as the discourse kind of evolved, I think my opinion ended up changing a bit. It might have been Geeta Jackson's review, because I think they did it for Polygon or one of them. But, you know, the importance of having like criticism from people who are going to kind of provide that more negative or critical lens on the topic, when so many of these other kind of reviews or essays on it were kind of not digging that deep. I think that's so important, right? And it feels like, unlike, you know, film or books, it seems like games specifically has a major kind of issue with like how it engages with criticism, and like how fan bases engage with criticism as being something that actually bolsters a work, whether it's a negative or positive response, versus it just kind of being like a hot take, or like you're dunking on something that people enjoy. And it seems like that's always the tightrope that we're seeing in this space of like, how do we carve out a place for criticism, and how do we educate people about how criticism isn't just like saying you dislike something. It's like actually spending time with, unpacking and engaging deeply with something that, for the most part, if you're going to write an essay about something, you probably are deeply intrigued by X video game in this case.
Yeah. And just like, I think that's right, where it's like, having to have a space to engage with stuff and to like really just like dig in. Phil, this might get us like way off track, but I don't know how much you've been engaging with. There have been a lot of essays recently about like what is the future of the English degree. There was one in the New Yorker, there was one in like the National Review. I don't know if you've seen any of those, but it's like, you know, is there a space for like that kind of criticism? Is like kind of the bulk of like what those are asking, like to kick it out even beyond our, you know, obviously you and I are focused on like games journalism and stuff. But it was kind of asking like, what are we doing when we've so devalued kind of like liberal arts degrees? Like, what is that? Where does that leave people in terms of how to engage with stuff? And I think like one of the takeaways was like, how do we help teach people to engage with stuff in a way where they can be critical of it in a way that still engages with it, instead of just like thing bad, move on. But like, how do we get to a point where it's like, okay, but like, why is it bad? Like, what is bad about it? And again, like, I don't know. I think it could be easy. I'm getting self-conscious here. I'm like, am I just like too up my own ass about this stuff? Because it's like, this is what I study and this is what I care about. But I think it's important.
No, I mean, I think that that New York Times article specifically would actually be like a really great thing for us to maybe unpack on the study hall and like really dive into it. Because, yeah, I mean, one of the quotes from that article that I've been lingering on is just like, you know, we're kind of in a moment right now where young people will have had the least amount of education on like human history and like humanities ever, and like how that's going to, you know, fundamentally change not only how we engage with each other, but also like media, history, you know, et cetera. And I mean, again, yeah, maybe we're biased because we studied those things, but it doesn't seem good. You know, it doesn't seem like that's a good trajectory to bring us down.
It doesn't. But counterpoint, are we turning into just old curmudgeons on the porch? I don't know.
You know, I've got the gray hairs coming in. It could be that. I just need to get my spittoon.
Worst part, they look really good.
Well, yeah. How about I'd love to actually kind of engage with that in a study hall. And yeah, I mean, I think that as you all can sense, talking to Natalie Watson, not only about immortality, which is also really engaged with like how we interact with and unpack media,
art, memory, and also talking what sticks around,
art, memory, like all these things. In addition to like our conversations around games journalism with her, I think it's definitely left us, you know, thinking about the future and, you know, the things we do here at Origin Story. So yeah, I don't know, Ben, I don't know if you had any closing thoughts, but I just found that this conversation, for one, was like really relaxed, but also like really kind of thought provoking.
I think yes to all of the above. I felt really good. I really appreciate Natalie talking to us. I do want to say, so now that we're like towards the end of the episode, I'm kind of assuming that everybody at this point has turned off the podcast, has stopped listening. There's like two or three people who might be still with us. And so here is a good place for me to say, I really appreciate that you didn't out me as a more civilized age listener, which I am. There was like a whole conversation beforehand where I was like, Phil, you can't out me. I listen to that pod all the time, which Natalie is one of the co-hosts on. And I was like, you can't do it, brother. And you were like, it's okay. Well, and I just, thank you.
You were sweating over there. But I mean, to be honest, there was moments I had to hold myself back from also kind of fanboying a bit and saying something about how she's a Keyblade master based off of like the 10-hour Kingdom Hearts deep dive that they did. So, you know, we're in the same boat here.
You know, did I pick up a Dooku Jedi Lost because of that podcast? Yes. Is that very embarrassing? Yes, it is.
if you all want to check out some of the awesome things that Natalie Watson is doing for More Civilized Age, or some of the older stuff that she did for Waypoint, or obviously if you haven't checked out Immortality, you know you can check her out on Twitter at Natalie Watson, and all the Immortality stuff at Half Mermaid Productions website. Yeah, thanks so much for listening, and we will see y'all here again on the next episode of Origin Story.
Whoop whoop!
Thanks again for checking out the show. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, it is 3DCisco on Twitter, as well as Instagram. And you can follow Ben on Twitter at sad_radio_lad. We wanted to thank Melody Hirsch, who designed all the awesome cover art and design work for the website and the podcast itself. And we wanted to thank Ryan Hopper, who does all the intro and outro music, as well as some of the interstitial stuff you hear in different episodes. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a review on iTunes, you know, subscribed on either iTunes or Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts. You know, reviews help just get the show in front of more people. And it only takes a couple of minutes. So yeah, if you could do that for us, it'd be greatly appreciated.
You should also visit our website at www.originstory.show. It's a great place to look at all of our episodes. There are full transcripts and a link to our Discord channel where we talk with listeners about everything OS and beyond. There's a lot of posting that goes on in there. So I don't know, if you're into that, come join us. You can also email us at theoriginstorypod@gmail.com. We're always looking for feedback, whether it's ideas for, you know, games that we should play, books that we should read, guests that we should have on the show. Just hit us up with thoughts, feelings. We're always looking for feedback, even if it's that Ben has an annoying voice and you don't want to hear it anymore. I mean, that's totally fine. So write us in. You can also follow us on Twitter at @originstory_ or our Instagram @originstory.show. As always, thanks for listening.